Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 238, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Stephen Yeh from Emory University. We discuss approaches to uveitis training as a trainee, the lessons he learned from his work with the Ebola virus, and how to apply those lessons in the context of COVID-19. We recorded this about a month ago, so if some of the information about COVID-19 might feel a little dated, but we do clarify that before our discussion. Remember, in the episode description, you can find a list of financial disclosures and information on how to claim CME credits for this episode and other episodes on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. I have two meetings coming up that you should be aware of. First, the Vitreoretinal Society 8 Virtual Series returns with Part 2, Vitrectomy in the Wild, featuring talks on the evolution of practice patterns during COVID-19, the latest developments in managing mild diabetic macular edema, scleral buckling pearls, and a robust surgical complications video session. The complications session is always one of the most popular components of that meeting, and it's going to be in its full entirety on this online webinar. It should be great. It will be Wednesday, June 24th at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, and registration is free. There is a link in the episode description, so you can go and register for that, and we'll have more information on that meeting coming up. Also, June 20th, Johns Hopkins University is hosting the first annual virtual resident ophthalmic trauma competition. There is also a link to register for that in the episode description. It'll be June 20th at 11 a.m. Eastern. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Stephen Yeh. Dr. Yeh is the M. Louise Simpson Professor in Ophthalmology at Emory Eye Center in Atlanta, Georgia, in the section of vitreoretinal surgery and disease, and also is the director of the section of uveitis and vasculitis at Emory. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Jay, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on the podcast with you and Straight from the Cutter.
Well, we've been, you're such a busy guy. You're one of the few ophthalmology celebrities, and so we're very happy to have you on. And what I mean by an ophthalmology celebrity, you're one of the few ophthalmologists, I think, that your name is maybe known to lay people as well as people in other fields for the work you've done. We'll talk a little bit about that. But I love getting background. One of the first questions we ask all new guests is how you kind of arrived at this point. So why did you choose ophthalmology, and then why a special interest in retina and uveitis?
Yeah, thanks, Jay, for that flattering introduction. I don't know about celebrity, but I do have a lot of curious interests. And one of those interests really is related to uveitis and retina. I developed my interest in uveitis from my background in immunology, which I've always been interested in. And at as a resident at the Baylor College of Medicine, many of my mentors, including Dr. Eric Holtz, Bill Mueller, and Tom Albini and Ross Lockenpaul, who were fellows at the time, really got me further interested in a career in retinal disease. And I think that having a balance of uveitis, which involves medicine and immunology, understanding rheumatology, neurology, and a lot of different fields, in combination with the surgical discipline of retina, being able to take care of vision-threatening conditions, sometimes more stressful than, as you know, that can be anxiety-provoking, but can be very rewarding. And so it's really balancing that medical and surgical aspect of what I was interested from the beginning of medical school and throughout residency and fellowship training.
And then your career path kind of took you into different places. You did spend some time at the NIH where you did do a fellowship in uveitis. I'm assuming did you work with Bernie Lusenblatt when you were there?
I did. And the 2 years at the National Eye Institute, the National Institutes of Health, were really several of my really wonderful years with Bob Nussenblatt on the uveitis side, as well as Dr. Emily Chu on medical retina. I also had a privilege of working with Dr. Grace Levy-Clark, who's in practice now in uveitis in Southeast United States. And I think during that time, I really was able to develop a lot of intellectual curiosity and really explore areas of uveitis, both from a basic sciences perspective, clinical immunology, and also the translational aspect of things, and really ask probing questions about some of these rare disease conditions. And that combined with working with Emily Chu on the medical retina side, thinking about clinical research, clinical trials, and ophthalmic imaging, really started to develop other further academic interests that have allowed me to pursue our current interest in infectious disease and uveitis, and that in addition to how you handle these conditions in the operating room as well.
You know, some people would say people who do multiple fellowships are academic. Some other people say they were glutton for punishment. You were in training for quite some time because after that you decided to go do a retina fellowship across the country in KC. You know, I get this question a lot from residents and fellows who are considering kind of doing retina with another fellowship like uveitis or oncology in terms of the order of operations and how they do that and the time investment. Did you know when you went to your fellowship at uveitis that you were definitely going to do a retina fellowship after? And when you advise your residents, do you tell them there's a specific order to follow in terms of how you time those two?
I think it depends. I mean, there's some really fantastic surgeons, as you know, in the country who've done dual training in uveitis and retinal disease. And you can do it both ways, where you do retina first and uveitis second. I would say that for individuals who are considering doing both fellowships, I think it is good if you're doing uveitis on the back end to have a component where there is an opportunity to operate and again continue to keep your feet wet and operating on a regular basis. In my decision making, it was related to specifically to that. The KCI Institute had a great surgical experience, and I wanted to really hit the ground running when I left fellowship and feel very comfortable being able to take care of disease in the operating room. And sometimes having if you do a 2-year uveitis fellowship and you're not in the operating room as much, I think there can be that a little bit of anxiety of getting back into the swing of things if you do a uveitis fellowship second. So I would lean towards uveitis first and retina second, but again, there's many different models and people can be very successful doing it either way.
Now, after your fellowship, you go to Emory. And then you've done many things there, working with the fellows, as well as developing the uveitis, continuing to develop the uveitis department there. You're best known to this point, and most of us don't have anything we're well known for, so this is already a credit given your young career, but you're best known for your work with Ebola. How did you get involved with that? I'm assuming the proximity to CDC played some role, but how did you get involved? What was kind of your experience working with Ebola? And you guys published extensively on the subject of Ebola in the eye. What did you find?
Well, thanks, Jay, for those kind words. And so it was really interesting, at least in terms of setting, because one of my first clinical and research interests was related to herpetic eye disease. And that's one of the reasons that I was drawn to Emory, because of its long history of working with CMV retinitis, with the work of Dan Martin and many others. And essentially, the Emory Eye Center has done a lot of infectious uveitis for a long time, both with Dan Martin, Sunil Srivastava, who preceded me. And when I got here, there are ties to the CDC, but as importantly, or perhaps even more importantly, the Emory University School of Medicine, Emory University Hospital, had a serious communicable disease unit that was sort of at the center for healthcare workers who were repatriated during the Ebola outbreak between 2014 and 2016 in West Africa. And when U.S. healthcare workers were repatriated, we were concerned about the possibility that they could be developing, that there was a risk of developing uveitis because there are rare reports from the Democratic Republic of Congo in the 1990s of uveitis in association with Ebola. These are rare. And so I reached out to one of my infectious disease colleagues, Dr. Jay Varkey, and I just told him if there's any patients who develop symptoms, then feel free to give us a call. There's obviously a lot of parallels between Ebola and COVID-19 in terms of the anxiety, the uncertainty with regards to an infectious disease process. As luck or fortune, I guess in some ways, some would have it. There was a patient who developed uveitis and severe sight-threatening uveitis around 3 months after he was diagnosed with Ebola. He had recovered from Ebola, and that's when the work really started. I worked with the infectious disease team and a close colleague, Dr. Jessica Shanta, who's on faculty at Emory. And while we were taking care of the physician, we identified Ebola virus inside his eye, and that was of clinical and scientific significance. As you and I both know, viruses can go to the eye as an immune privileged location. But the eye as an immune privileged location and a potential area of clinical interest was not as widely known in the infectious disease field. And so, after that, we started exploring the possibility that Ebola patients in West Africa could be developing this potentially sight-threatening disease as well. And so that really took our team, including myself, Dr. Jessica Shanta, Dr. Brent Hayek, and many others to Liberia, Sierra Leone, And since then, we've also traveled to Democratic Republic of Congo to explore this question further. And really, the rest is history. It's been about a 5-year adventure in exploring this, and that's really led us to really think about outbreaks, emerging infectious diseases, including the coronaviruses. And here we are, all of us in this really challenging and unprecedented situation.
So the most topical thing recording this today on May 6, 2020, the only reason I mentioned the date is because the news keeps changing. And if someone listens to in 3 weeks, there might be something that we don't mention that's come out. But everyone wants to talk about COVID-19. I mean, obviously, it's the big, from a public health and infectious disease standpoint, epidemiology standpoint, this is the most significant pandemic affecting human life and worldwide since the Spanish flu in 1918. None of us have lived through anything like this. There's nothing really we can compare to it in terms of its impact. And we can talk a little bit about the trickle-down effects of that. But purely from your experience working with infectious disease specialists, the CDC, working with Ebola, which is a very different sort of disease in terms of fatality, but also very different because of the different transmission and transmissibility, what sort of lessons did you learn from your Ebola experience that kind of, when you started first seeing and hearing about COVID-19, and then there was this discussion of is this something that could be transmissible through ocular fluids, for example? What were kind of your initial impressions and the lessons you take from your Ebola experience?
Yeah, Jay, that's a really, really great question. And I'm glad, I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this, because I do think that it's amazing to me to see how many parallels that there are. And as you mentioned, the viruses are very different in terms of the method of transmission, the mortality rate. But at the same time, when you take a step back and think big picture, what things look like in West Africa, it turns out that Ebola was primarily a disease that was seen in Central Africa. So you saw this in Democratic Republic of Congo. You would see this in little pockets within Africa, but it had never been seen before in West Africa. And so when the Ebola outbreak started to happen first in Guinea and traveling to Liberia and Sierra Leone, there was some I would say disbelief or that it actually existed. Was Ebola really going on? It wasn't until it hit the capital city of Freetown in Sierra Leone that it really started was really magnified in the minds of the communities, and obviously from a life-threatening disease standpoint, it really had issues with destroying communities and families and everything because the mortality was so high. And so when we think about COVID-19, we think about preparedness and even uncertainty about what, was America going to be affected? Was it as bad as everybody said it was, and what was going on in other countries? But you saw this surge sort of coming, and really, at least when you rewind 2 months, you think about what were the ways that we could prepare for this. And it's difficult to completely prepare, because how could we prepare for something like this, right? You had mentioned Spanish flu and things that are in our lifetime. And I think that kind of goes back to, how do we approach questions that come up, both with the clinical disease that we may or may not face in ophthalmology? How do we approach just systems and health system strengthening? I think these really take a methodical approach. And I think that with every clinical decision that we make, whether it's seeing a patient with conjunctivitis in the clinic with no known history of COVID-19, and now we know that COVID-19 can lead to conjunctivitis, this type of decision, or how do we go back into the workforce safely and protect all of our staff? And how do we study these questions, and how do we continue to educate medical students and residents even in this context? I think taking each question individually, really drawing on expertise of other individuals and partners, and then coming up with decisive action for making sure that we can ensure both care of patients as well as educational opportunities, and think about how to protect all of us. I think these are the very methodical approach, the very rigorous approach, really drawing on the expertise of many individuals, and ultimately taking decisive action. I think these are some of the lessons that I think about in comparison when I'm thinking about these two outbreaks.
And it's funny you mentioned PPE. Later today, actually, I'm doing a call with Dr. Chandra, who wrote the Royal College of Ophthalmology's PPE recommendations in the United Kingdom, and then Dr. Dan Chow, who kind of spearheaded it here. We were both kind of included in that effort, and I'll talk to them a little more about the PPE aspect. I think, right. And this is just an aside, and just because we're on the subject of Ebola and COVID-19, it's funny, for those of us who
read these kind of action thriller novels, a couple of different authors have written about the idea of a pandemic or a generated pandemic. Tom Clancy actually wrote a book. I don't know if you know about this, Rainbow Six, which spawned a popular video game years ago. And this, the topic of the book was they actually, it was a terrorist environmental group, which I'm not implying any sort of conspiracy here to today, but in the book, but in the book, they actually took Ebola and they aerosolized it. And that was the whole idea, right? Was you, and that's, that would obviously be even worse than coronavirus, given the mortality associated with Ebola. Absolutely. But this has been a concern, as we've, you referenced, this has been a concern on the minds of many public health people, is there are these diseases that all it takes is that switch to, all it comes down to is how are they transmitted. There are certain modes of transmission that are quick, such as aerosolization, and there are certain modes of transmission like direct contact with blood or bodily fluids that are slower and kind of limit the spread of these diseases. When you were working with Ebola, was this something that was discussed? Because I feel like Ebola is something that kind of goes in and out of the media. You were involved in some articles that were published in the New York Times about it. It captures the public interest, and then it sort of fizzles, like many things do in the media, because it's just, you know, they want to move on to, people move on to something else. But this is like almost, not to say things could be worse with coronavirus, but the relative mortality is actually not that high. You could really imagine a worst case scenario as a public health person that this isn't actually the worst case scenario. And maybe that we need to have kind of better plans in place for what could happen if there's something that's more fatal that becomes aerosolized.
I mean, Jay, you're absolutely right. And I've, to be honest, I've actually shied away a little bit about talking about that it could be worse type scenario, because I think most people don't, you know, right now it just, it's obviously already from a societal and economic and even a, you know, a healthcare standpoint, I mean, extremely challenging to say the least. But you're absolutely right. In a scenario where there's high transmissibility and aerosolization and a higher, case fatality rate, then the situation could be even more devastating than it already appears to be. And I think that's why, like, when we think about preparedness measures, Ebola, in some ways, I mean, it was devastating, even in terms of 28,600 individuals affected in West Africa, and over 11,300 deaths already. When we think about the death toll already of COVID-19, it really, I think, behooves us to think about what are the preparedness measures that we even need to develop right now, really, like in this current environment, to think about ways that we have systems to, again, provide healthcare for patients, also to provide education, whether it's a medical student, resident. I think that this podcast, and I'm not just saying this, Jay, is a great example of ways that you continue to educate and inform others with the current technology that we have available, because this type of technology is extremely scalable in terms of reaching thousands of individuals very, very quickly. And the type of education that one needs to protect themselves against infectious disease is very, very specific. It's very specific. It's very methodical. It can be developed. But I think that it is hard to scale this, especially when there's widespread anxiety and even panic in some situations. But you're absolutely right. I think this is the time where we really think about all of these different systems. And even, I'm not an economics and business person, but I think that from a business standpoint, what is your revenue generating model when everything shuts down? I mean, how do you continue to generate revenue to sustain revenue for businesses? And these are questions I think all of us as a society are dealing with. And then we have, our insight is going to be within the healthcare realm, and you have special insight into communication and also vitreoretinal surgery. I think that these are ways that I think that we can help improve the healthcare and really strengthen the healthcare system right now. I think this is something that we need to do in the coming months, and who knows how long. I mean, this could be here for a while, and so I think that we all need to be thinking about and answering these questions, or at least trying to answer the questions the best that we can.
Yeah, and I think this fact kind of feeds into what you're referencing, this discussion people have had, which is, you know, people kind of have this throwaway statement, whether it's in passing when you're talking to somebody or just in the media, radio, TV. Well, things are never going to be the same, or this is the new normal. But maybe not knowing the specifics of what that means, right? And I think that in a lot of ways it could be the new normal. We saw after September 11th a completely different sort of tragedy, a human-generated tragedy on a different scale. You know, air travel never really went back to being the same. I think security measures in some way have gotten lighter than they were immediately following September 11th and then those following years. But it has never gone back to, hey, you can just walk up to the gate with your family member, they get on the plane, and you stand there with them until they get on, right? I mean, it's a little different, and it probably will never go back to that. And so when we kind of apply that to our field and what the people are listening, they're obviously thinking about their practices, how their volume for the practices, but there's also sort of our conferences and our meetings and all these things that are feasible via technology, but there is something that's lost a little bit when you lose that in-person aspect, right? So you think of that the big meetings right. in our field, AAO or ASRS or at the AUS meeting, and these are meetings that a lot of the value comes from that human interaction. But if you're talking about preventing this sort of spread in the future, I mean, are we going to go back to that meeting model at any point? Like, is it feasible? Does it make sense? Or were we just kind of flirting with fire this whole time with these huge, large meetings and conferences and conventions this whole time? Should we take a permanent lesson from this and kind of alter how we do things? Because I think it would be a shame in a way if our residents and fellows never really experienced those meetings. Because I think the first time I went to ASRS, for example, as a resident, it blew my mind. I just thought it increased my excitement and interest in the field. Maybe that isn't something that they'll experience, just like kids who were born in 2000 never experienced walking to the gate with their grandparents when they fly out of town.
Yeah. I mean, that's really a fascinating, perspective. And Brett, you're right. I mean, what is the quote, the new normal really look like? I think it's really hard to say. And I think that as we sort of like continue to watch the numbers and it's really even interesting to me how the models change so much. And depending on what assumptions are placed into the specific models for healthcare, and then that in terms of disease transmission and what happens next, I think that will also determine, help to answer some of these questions. Like what is an in-person meeting really look like? Are you 3 to 6 feet away from your neighbor as opposed to these packed halls, that, as you mentioned, for these lectures? And so, I think that your guess is as good as mine. I it seems like at least, you know, from a timing standpoint for the near future, I think it's hard to conceptualize a meeting that we get excited about and attend with thousands of our colleagues, but depending on how things go with the numbers, I mean, you can see that opening back up maybe slowly at first, but then getting back to full steam ahead. I will say that when you look at again, sort of going back to the Ebola in West Africa environment, I do think that getting back to quote unquote the normal, I think takes a long time, but then there are some things that we see that are sort of remnants of the outbreak that ended in the West African outbreak. You still have hand washing stations. There's a heightened sense of taking care of individuals who have previously been affected with Ebola, and I think that these are things that we can anticipate as well. It's like, you know, how do we become more resilient as a society? How do we avoid stigma for individuals who were affected with COVID-19 because they need care as well? And so some of these issues I think that we're also going to be dealing with down the road, and sort of implicit with that is, how do we deal with the mental health and psychosocial stressors of individuals who are going through this very, very challenging time on a number of levels? And so these are all big picture issues that we're dealing with in society, but also within medicine, perhaps in particular as healthcare workers. There are many stresses associated with these specific situations where you're faced with potential transmission and infection risk.
You know, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, Steve, but a couple things that I want to touch on before we go. You know,
sure.
Let's take that large meeting kind of scale and scale it down to interviews. You know, I sit on a residency application committee, just like you. I interview vitreoretinal fellows in the fall. I mean, that has always traditionally been done in person. And we were just talking before we came on the air, like, you even remember when, you know, when I was applying our class and we interviewed, you got to meet all of us. And you know, there's value to that beyond just interviewing the candidate. You obviously maybe learn more. At least we think we learn more about people in person than we would over a video or over phone. But you also develop those relationships, especially in retina fellowship interviews, that you meet somebody and now they're going to be your colleague the rest of your career, and you still remember those people. We were just asked here, and we're writing an article about, you know, with a commentary was, you know, are we going to be interviewing applicants in person? Do we have to modify things like that? I mean, having interviewed and worked with vitreoretinal fellows and done these interviews for a long time, what are your thoughts on that and kind of the in-person aspect of interviews?
I mean, I think that there's just tremendous value in sort of the face to face interview. But then, I mean, that's great that you guys are thinking about that already. Because then I was thinking, what does that look like? Is it a face to face interview with a mask on? Is it does it make if so? Then maybe it makes more sense to have a face to face on a computer Zoom or a BlueJeans conference call. And what are the interview etiquette rules with regards
right,
to?
Right.
I mean, do you still wear a suit? I mean, I'm not sure like how that all works. And so I think again,
what background do you use?
Yeah, what background do you use? Do you use your beach background, or do you use a photograph that you've taken? And you know, wow, I just think again, there's really no definite. I mean, I don't think the COVID-19 playbook, you know, has been written as of yet. But I think that Jay, you and your colleagues are continuing to help write it. And then so within that, you know, in that aspect, then I think it's important to think about these questions and really, again, drawing up on your experiences that you've already been utilizing. And that's a great question. I can see that happening, that we have an organized Zoom interview schedule. I think things look similar in the fall, but hopefully that won't be the case.
Well, last question I want to ask you, Steve, because, again, we were talking about this before you came on the air. Residents and fellows who are interested in academic careers are always interested in how do you kind of develop a career? How do you find a niche? You know, how do you continue to grow it? How do you kind of continue to set goals and structure those goals over time so you don't either A, burn out, or B, lose interest, where you're not just kind of going through the motions? Any quick thoughts or tips for the residents and fellows before we break?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question, Jay. So I think that, you know, for the residents and fellows, I think a lot of it, it's a really a great stage because you have mentors and you're in academic and private practice institutions that have individuals who want to do research and want to do projects and want to teach clinically. And so I would say taking advantage of the opportunities that are offered. And as residents and fellows continue to develop, whether it's writing papers or seeing patients, I think it's always important to keep on asking questions and not being afraid of taking a risk when it comes to scientific curiosity. And that's something that I learned from Bob Nussenbaugh. Was really when I do have a scientific interest or a question, to not be afraid of thinking about ways to approach that question. And that would be the biggest tip that I would give to especially to the fellows and individuals or perhaps graduating residents, is to really, really chase that inquiry. Because if you take one step and you take another step, you never know where it's going to lead. And you do that with your mentors and you do it with your specific research interests. And that really can help your academic career really blossom from your specific scientific interests that you're passionate about.
Steve, thanks so much for your time. I know you're super busy and look forward to hopefully at some point seeing you, if not in person, in an online meeting coming soon to us.
Yeah, Jay, thanks so much again. Congratulations to you and all of your team at Straight from the Cutter for this great communication mechanism.
Take care. Have a great day.
Take care.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 238 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You can click on a link at the bottom to subscribe to our email list. That will give you updates on the most recent episodes. I like to subscribe on my mobile device, so I use my Apple Podcast app on my iPhone, or you can use the similar app on your Android device. It's one of the more convenient ways to keep track of the episodes as they come out. Remember that you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter, and if you have any ideas or thoughts on future episodes, please reach out to us at retinapodcast@gmail.com or by emailing us directly. If you click on the Contact Us link on our website, that will generate a form you can fill out and send in ideas for future episodes or any feedback. Thank you to Dr. Steve Yeh for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Mike Minicasa for their help putting this episode and all the social media together. Could not do it without those guys. And thank you to listeners, what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here every week. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling. This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.